Fed Chair Janet Yellen wraps up her last interest rate decision. Home ownership is up for the first time in more than a decade. And yeah, we'll talk about that speech last night, too. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, D.C., I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Wednesday, the 31st of January. Thanks for being with us. Janet Yellen presided over the Federal Open Market Committee meeting for the last time as chair today. As expected, the committee left interest rates alone for now, but signaled that more increases could come later this year if inflation picks up. Inflation depends on higher wages, and there is some news today on that front. After years of minimal wage growth, the Department of Labor said today that pay in the private sector is up 2.8% from this time last year. That doesn't leave too much extra cash for workers once you factor in what inflation we do have, but it's the best number we've seen since early 2015. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports.
There are lots of factors that can hold back wage growth and lots that can boost it. But according to Kristen Monaco at the Bureau of Labor Statistics,
generally speaking, as the labor market tightens, I think everyone expects to see upward pressure on wages and benefits.
Which is basically what we're seeing now. There's more competition for fewer available workers, so wages are going up. Ryan Bourne at the Cato Institute says minimum wage increases have also helped.
But really, to get robust wage growth, what you ultimately need is productivity growth. And unfortunately, that's been pretty low.
Meaning each worker needs to produce more to really push up wages. There's also the issue of worker mobility and the tight housing supply. If you can't move easily, you're stuck with the wages where you are. And if there are only one or two employers with your kind of job in your area, then wages really get stuck.
So this is a concept called monopsony, which is the labor market equivalent to monopoly.
Yes, monopsony. This economics lesson is from Kate Bonn at the Center for American Progress.
A classic example in economics is like a coal mining town where workers can not actually go find another employer. There's only one employer within their hometown.
And that one employer can keep wages low if they want. Bond says with lots of consolidation in sectors like healthcare and retail, even a worker shortage may not be enough to push wages up quickly. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Something else that's going up? People owning homes. New data from the Census Bureau show the rate of home ownership rose last year for the first time in more than a decade to a little more than 64%. In several big cities, though, renters now outnumber homeowners. Marketplace's Renata Sago explains what's going on.
The boost in the nation's homeowner rate is kind of a big deal because we're still watching whether the market has recovered from its collapse when so many swapped deeds for leases. Around 1.5 million more people bought a house in 2017 than the year before, according to the U.S. Census Bureau.
We're finally seeing the confluence of not only jobs coming back, but wages slowly but surely starting to rise. The folks are feeling comfortable enough to buy.
Darren Bloomquist tracks real estate trends for Adam Data Solutions. He found the home ownership rate for first-time buyers under age 35 grew four times more than other groups. Cities that saw the biggest boost are those with good jobs and lots of housing. Atlanta, Phoenix, Nashville, and Seattle, to name a few. Some places, San Francisco, New York, and Los Angeles, have plenty of jobs, but not enough housing. Cheryl Young is chief economist for the real estate website Trulia.
Prices are so high right now. There's really low inventory, a lot of competition. So it is a tough market out there.
U.S. Census Bureau data shows in about a quarter of the nation's 100 biggest cities, renters are now the majority of residents. University of Wisconsin real estate professor Steve Malpezzi says the national homeowner rate just doesn't apply to places where there's major demand.
Population's going up, employment's going up, but you can't build, or you can't build enough to catch up.
And that's not an equation any big city can change quickly. I'm Renata Sago for Marketplace.
In his State of the Union address last night, President Trump singled out ExxonMobil and its plan to invest more than $50 billion in the U.S. over the next 5 years, which, for the record, would actually be less than what it invested the previous 5 years. Some of that new investment centers on the Permian Basin in Texas, where output has tripled in the past 3 years. From Austin, Marketplace's Andy Euler reports.
The Permian Basin's not a new player in the oil game. This part of West Texas and New Mexico has been producing oil for more than a century. Joseph Tripke runs Infill, an oil field research firm. He's not surprised ExxonMobil says it's going to triple production here in the next 7 years. With oil prices around $65 a barrel, it's a no-brainer.
The Permian was one of the only markets in the world that was growing with oil prices $20 south of here. And so now with oil prices here, we're just seeing that push accelerate.
The Permian now produces more oil and gas than some major oil-producing countries. Carr Ingham is an economist with the Texas Alliance of Energy Producers. He says OPEC countries are no longer the single influential swing producer whose decisions drive global prices up or down.
They could ratchet up production or ratchet down production to control prices. All of that changed when the U.S. began to rapidly increase crude oil productions.
In today's market,
we're the wild card.
Fred Beach teaches energy and technology policy at the University of Texas at Austin. He argues it's now the United States that has more clout.
OPEC can exercise, to some degree, control over their members and what they do. The U.S., all bets are off, boy. It's the wild, wild west. It's free market.
And at this price point, American producers are in a leading position regardless of what OPEC does. Energy independence is still a ways off, but the U.S. government might be a bit more willing to use its new position of power to apply sanctions on oil-producing countries like Venezuela or Iran, without as much fear of shaking up the world economy. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, a little skittish after that Fed meeting. Details when we do the numbers. We started the show looking at wages, and it was one of the economic topics President Trump highlighted in his State of the Union speech last night. He also hit on immigration and job growth, but we're going to spend a few minutes focusing on another issue the administration sees as essential to economic growth, regulations.
In our drive to make Washington accountable, we have eliminated more regulations in our first year than any administration in the history of our country.
Chrissy Clark from Marketplace's Wealth and Poverty Desk has spent the past few months exploring federal regulations for our documentary podcast, The Uncertain Hour. She joins me now. Hi, Chrissy.
Hey, Amy.
So first of all, that clip where Trump said he's eliminated more regulations in his first year than any administration. Is that true?
It's such a simple sentence, right? But there's actually a lot packed into it that needs some unpacking. So first of all, the claim itself, the Trump administration is definitely in a deregulatory mood and has made efforts to undo some very significant regulations, net neutrality, some key regulations around greenhouse gas emissions. But it would actually be pretty difficult to measure how many regulations the president has eliminated compared to every other president in history. For one, a lot of the government records tracking that sort of thing only go back to 1995, so that wouldn't even cover the Reagan and Carter administrations, which both went big on deregulation. And then when you look at the list that the White House issued recently, this list of 67, quote, deregulatory actions that the Trump administration undertook in its first 11 months, just a few of them were deemed economically significant by the White House itself. And many of the actions on the list were actually underway before Trump took office. So that's some things to keep in mind. But then there's another thing I think that's really important to point out about how President Trump talked about regulations last night. And I want you to listen to something he said right after he made that claim.
In Detroit, I halted government mandates that crippled America's great, beautiful auto workers so that we can get Motor City revving its engines again. And that's what's happening.
So those government mandates in Detroit, what exactly is he talking about there?
Well, that's what's kind of interesting is that he's not specific about what he's talking about there. And if you look at opinion polls about regulation for the last decade or so, in general, Americans are about evenly split on whether regulation of business usually does more harm than good or whether it's necessary to protect the public interest. But when you ask people about specific types of regulations, there's actually more consensus. For example, with environmental regulations, in most recent polls, most Americans, almost 60%, say environmental regulations are worth the cost,
So you're saying actually most Americans would be in favor of environmental regulation.
Right. And the specific government mandate that President Trump was likely talking about halting last night when he mentioned Detroit was an environmental regulation. He didn't mention it by name, but last spring, Trump announced that his administration was going to reconsider the tighter fuel efficiency standards for cars that had been set in the waning days of the Obama administration.
And what about that argument that President Trump made that these restrictions would have crippled workers?
So that's a theme you hear a lot from him and many in Congress. There's this common buzzword that people use, job-killing regulations. And I spoke to a professor at the University of Pennsylvania named Carrie Colonisi, who wrote a book investigating just that issue. It's called Does Regulation Kill Jobs? And the answer is not exactly. I mean, some regulations, like some technology or other changes in the world, will definitely mean certain companies will close down or lay off workers. And that will be really painful for those people who are affected. But that's only looking at one side of the ledger.
Companies that might close down because they have to install some costly pollution control technology, let's say, there's going to be companies that stay in business and are buying that pollution control technology and therefore sort of supporting businesses and promoting jobs in that pollution control industry.
And when you look at the jobs data overall, Carrie Colonisi says the consensus among most economists is that there's just not a good case that regulations mean fewer jobs across the economy.
All right, Chrissy Clark on the regulation beat for us these days. Chrissy hosts our documentary podcast. It's called The Uncertain Hour. Thanks, Chrissy.
Thank you, Amy.
Last week's shooting at a high school in Kentucky, where two students died, is renewing a conversation about how to help survivors. After these tragedies, people and companies open their wallets to provide aid. It's happening in Kentucky now. After the mass shooting at a country music festival in Las Vegas last October, people donated more than $22 million. Private donations are just one source of funding for victims. There are government programs, too. But deciding how to divvy up the money is becoming an unfortunately common challenge for communities. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explains.
$22 million in donations. Sounds like a lot. But there were 58 people killed in Las Vegas, more than 500 wounded, and some 22,000 in attendance at the show.
I don't have a big speech or anything. My daughter is one of the victims.
Survivors and their families gathered at a public forum a couple months back to share how they thought those $22 million should be distributed and how the shootings affected them mentally, physically, financially.
I have soft tissue damage to my leg. I am not able to be on my feet.
I'm sleeping about 3 hours a night.
The night terrors, the memories, it's so very real.
This has caused me to have to go through my savings, live on my credit cards.
Lots of speakers said they thought some of the donations should go to people who'd escaped without physical injuries, those suffering mental trauma. But last month, the Las Vegas Victims Fund finalized its criteria for giving away the money it's raised. The highest amounts will go to families of those killed or survivors with permanent brain damage or paralysis. Other funds will go to victims who were hospitalized with physical injuries, and a third tier will go to victims with physical injuries but who weren't hospitalized. Mental trauma is ineligible.
Usually, mental injury, however reasonable and however legitimate, is ineligible for compensation because there's not enough money to pay for it.
Kenneth Feinberg is a lawyer who advised the Las Vegas Fund and has administered countless other funds from September 11th to the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting. Specific rules vary, but typically,
you use hospitalization as a pretty good barometer of seriousness of injury. And everybody who falls within that category of hospitalization stay gets the same amount of money.
Doesn't matter who the person is, whether they need the money for medical care or not, everyone is treated the same. Typically, they get a lump sum and can use the money for whatever they want.
This is all cold math. That's what this is. Very efficient, very streamlined, and very quick.
Efficient, but not easy.
You are dealing with people whose lives have been destroyed. And money is a pretty poor substitute for loss.
Again, that process is for donations. Other support may be available through various nonprofits, and each state has its own victims' compensation program. Allison Turkell is a deputy director at the Department of Justice's Office of Victims of Crime.
So they could get funding for medical care, mental health care, funeral costs. Some states for caregiver expenses. Those are sort of the big categories.
Victims may be able to get repaid for lost wages as well. This is funding that's supposed to fill the gaps that insurance and other programs don't cover. But every state is different, and Turkell says sometimes it's not enough.
Some states pay about $15,000, and other states go up to about $70,000. So there's a wide range.
Plus, getting victims the help they need, Turkell says it's still an emerging field.
We've had really a concentrated amount of these large-scale mass violence incidents. And then we've had, obviously, many more in the last few years. So we're learning from our past experiences.
And learning how enduring victim needs can be, how lasting the impacts of these shootings are for survivors and their communities. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace. Coming up.
I found myself without a job in an economy that was basically not hiring anyone.
And for international students, it was even worse. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 72 points, more than a quarter of a percent, to close at 26,149. The NASDAQ up 9 points, a tenth of a percent, to finish at 7,411. And the S&P 500 advanced 1 point, essentially unchanged, to end at 2823. We talked about plans for increased domestic oil production. ExxonMobil revved up nearly 0.6%. Chevron stalled, pretty much unchanged. On home ownership, the National Association of Realtors says that pending home sales were up in December for the third straight month. U.S. home builder D.R. Horton hammered up 1%. KB Home knocked down nearly 3%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.71%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. Earlier today, Dr. Brenda Fitzgerald resigned from her post as director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. This came after a report in Politico detailed a series of stock purchases made by Fitzgerald, including shares of tobacco companies. One of the CDC's priorities is reducing tobacco use. Sarah Carlin-Smith has been on the story for Politico, where she covers healthcare. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me what Brenda Fitzgerald was invested in and why it was perceived, at least, to be a conflict of interest.
Sure. So before she came into office, Brenda Fitzgerald had a very big stock portfolio, and it included everything from tobacco stocks to food companies, all these areas in which the Center for Disease Control and Prevention plays a huge role. And then while she was already in office, she bought new stocks in these areas, and that really, I think, set off alarm bells for people that she was continuing to make stock purchases in these conflicts, particularly tobacco stocks, which is such a big area for CDC in terms of encouraging anti-smoking efforts. And so that dynamic really caused her a big problem.
One of the producers here at Marketplace, when he saw this story, pointed out, you know, probably a lot of us who are, you know, passive investors with 401ks or index funds have some kind of investment in tobacco companies. How is this different than that?
So these are not index funds or mutual funds. These are specific separate stock holdings. And so the federal government would allow somebody in her position to own an index fund or fund with, you know, multiple different stocks. And that wouldn't be seen as a conflict, but owning the individual stock would be. The other thing here, and, you know, CDC Director Brenda Fitzgerald, through spokesperson at HHS, they told us that her financial advisor made the purchases. And in talking to ethics officials, it would have been her responsibility to let her financial advisor know. So regardless of whether she was giving direct sign-off or not, there's a certain responsibility here for her to make sure she's not purchasing financial investments that interfere with her job.
There have been questions about other administration officials and their divestment from industries they're currently overseeing. Why does Brenda Fitzgerald lose her job?
You know, I think that's a really great question. HHS was already under a lot of scrutiny because Tom Price, its first secretary under the Trump administration, resigned after he was found to be taking private planes. And they just got a new HHS secretary who may want to kind of come in and put the department on a fresh start. And the other thing people just kept mentioning is tobacco. It really stands out as being such a big conflict for the CDC's mission. And finally, actually, I should also add that Congress has been very focused on Brenda Fitzgerald's divestment, and they just have been frustrated that she can't actually do her job because of the divestments. And I think it was a coming together of a lot of factors for her that kind of coalesced in this resignation.
All right. Sarah Carlin Smith wrote about CDC Director Brenda Fitzgerald's resignation for Politico. Thanks so much for coming on.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
All this year, Marketplace is exploring how the financial crisis and its aftermath changed America. It's a project we're calling Divided Decade. As part of our coverage, we're hearing from people around the country about how the financial crisis and recession affected them personally, their spending habits, their outlooks, their next steps. For today's installment, we hear from 33-year-old John Kadenda. In September 2008, John was an international student from Kenya, starting his senior year at the University of Texas. He'd also just finished an internship at Merrill Lynch and was on his way to a career in investment banking.
I got a full-time offer. Of course, the end of September of 2008 is when the financial crash happened. By the end of that year, Merrill Lynch was teetering on the edge of collapse and ended up getting sold to Bank of America. As a result of that, they came under the regulation that prevented Bank of America from hiring any new foreign workers, at least until they paid back TARP funding to the federal government. I found myself without a job in an economy that was basically not hiring anyone, let alone international students who require the company to spend upwards of $5,000 in order to finance the work visa application fee process. After a lot of panicking and stress and soul searching, I decided to intern at a local Austin company and take an additional semester of school. At the end of that process, I was able to secure a job with a healthcare analytics firm. It ended up being probably one of the best things that happened to me in terms of career trajectory. And looking back, I think I would have really hated being an investment banker. I think in the next 2, maximum 5 years, we'll have another crash. Because the phrase that kept coming up time and time again when the financial crisis was at its peak was that these banks are too big to fail. The banks that were too big to fail have swallowed other banks that were too big to fail, and so they're even bigger now.
You can see photos of John Kadenda on Instagram at MarketplaceAPM. And tell us how the financial crisis changed you with the hashtag #HowWeChanged. It's all part of our year-long series, Divided Decade. This final note, Medieval Times is doing its part for gender equity. The New York Times reports the Middle Ages-themed restaurant is replacing all of its kings with queens. For 34 years, the dinner theater show has featured a male monarch. The show's director told the Times, the timing of the change is a coincidence and not a direct response to the national conversation about gender in the workplace. The waitresses, known as wenches, aren't going anywhere. After all, it's supposed to be historical. And that's our show. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 72 points, more than a quarter of a percent. The NASDAQ up 9 points, a tenth of a percent. And the S&P 500 went up 1 point, basically unchanged. Sarah Brugger, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Carlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer the program for us. I'm Amy Scott. I will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.